Merci beaucoup, mes condos, que la barrière chat.
Well, Amazon made headlines Tuesday when it became the second American company after Apple to reach $1 trillion in value. Amazon's founder and chief executive Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world with a net worth of more than $167 billion. But what's behind that wealth? What about its workers?
The working conditions in Amazon's warehouses have been the focus of protests, union drives, several investigations, including by student reporters. Students go back to school around the country. Juan, we're going to go to a report by a group of your students at Rutgers University. Can you introduce this?
Yeah, well, this is a group of my students in my investigative reporting class who did both a written and a video report on Amazon, because there are now about 10 warehouses just in the state of New Jersey, that 15,000 workers that are employed by Amazon. This is Kristen Charlery of the Rutgers Student I Team.
Millions of Americans every day ship and receive packages from Amazon. In fact, the company just announced that it has exceeded more than 100 million Prime members, more than the population of Germany.
Amazon is one of the fastest growing companies in the U.S. In the Garden State alone, they employ 15,000 workers with 10 warehouses.
Amazon prides itself on being fast, reliable, and convenient. But when shopping online, we oftentimes only see the end result of what we purchase. But what about the process to get the delivery to you? What goes on inside the fulfillment centers? What is the plight of the average Amazon worker? According to past and current employees, it's not an easy job.
An investigation of Amazon operations by Rutgers student team found numerous cases in recent years of workers being injured and even killed at the company's fulfillment centers because of poor safety conditions, and fines levied against the company or its subcontractors by federal inspectors for safety violations. Beginning in 2013 and ending in 2017, 7 workers died in Amazon warehouses. The deaths prompted the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health to place Amazon on their Dirty Dozen list for 2018. This list is comprised of employers that put workers at risk due to unsafe practices.
My name is Philip J. Pellegrino. I am 68 years old.
Hi, I'm Ada Bradley. I'm 20.
I work at Amazon's Cranberry Fulfillment Center. On January 31st of 2018, I was working in the 300 Niles County, and I lifted up a very heavy, awkward package, which turned out to be a trailer tow package for a passenger vehicle. And as I lifted it out of the bin, I heard something snap in my left arm. Okay, felt a lot of pain, and realized that I sustained an injury. January 31st was Wednesday. It was the last day of my work week. When I came back the following week, I filed a workers' comp claim. And the claim was, after about 10 days, denied by a company called Sedgwick, which is Amazon's insurance company for workers' compensation. I was never given an explanation as to why it was denied. I requested it. They told me for various reasons. I said specifically what reasons. Okay, and they said, we can't tell you that. And they never gave me a medical examination to determine the extent of my injury, but denied my claim.
It was weird because it was my first day like on the job. And we were walking around and this one boy, he was like, don't work here. This is basically slavery. And I think it's just because it was really like hard work to do. So people, I mean, we were getting paid. So they were just like, oh yeah, this is like basically slavery.
If they were to enforce rigidly their safety regulations in those aisles, it would have a detrimental impact on operational efficiency.
We asked Lou Kimmel of the New Labor Worker Advocacy Group why federal health and agencies don't do more to protect workers.
My name is Lou Kimmel. I'm the executive director of New Labor, also co-founder of the organization. OSHA is chronically underfunded. Companies don't want to have unionized workforce because it means paying more money and more benefits in their minds, right? So their justification is always to keep things the way they are. And they have the economic wherewithal to do that pretty effectively. At the same time, compared to other warehouses, they do pay more and offer a little bit better benefit package. So there's that disincentive. People might feel more comfortable with what they're making because of that situation.
Amazon declined to respond to our questions, but the company has said previously of deaths at the facility, safety is our number one priority. As we do with any incident, we are reviewing our practices and protocols to ensure the well-being of our employees.
They say that safety is first, not the case. What's first is get that product to the customer. And if you don't, there's the parking lot, get in your car and leave.
So the next time you click and order something online on Amazon, think of the hidden workers that make that all possible.
Reporting for the Rutgers I-Team,
I'm Kristen Shallery.
So that was a report by my students at the Rutgers Department of Journalism and Media Studies. There were five of them on this particular team that had actually a much bigger, longer written report, which we'll link to online. But it's Kristen Shallery, Dan Israel, Kira Herzog, Manya Goldstein, and Rosa Haliva.
And just as we watch that report, independent Senator Bernie Sanders has targeted Amazon for its role in widening the wage gap in the United States. Senator Sanders spoke Monday at an AFL-CIO Labor Day breakfast and called out Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos by name.
Amazon responded to ongoing criticism from Sanders last week in a blog post saying, quote, Amazon is proud to have created over 130,000 new jobs last year alone. In the U.S., the average hourly wage for a full-time associate in our fulfillment centers, including cash, stock, and incentive bonuses, is over $15 an hour before overtime. We encourage anyone to compare our pay and benefits to other retailers.
This week, Senator Sanders expected to unveil legislation requiring large employers like Amazon to cover the cost of federal assistance received by their workers. More on working conditions at Amazon. We're going to Britain right now to speak with journalist James Bloodworth, who spent a month working undercover as a picker in an Amazon order fulfillment center and found workers were urinating in bottles because they were discouraged from taking bathroom breaks. His new book is Hired, 6 months Undercover in Low-Wage Britain. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, James. Lay out what you found about Amazon. You've been tweeting nonstop about it hitting $1 trillion. Its CEO, its founding head, Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world.
I've been tweeting about it and doing things like this in the media because it's really important, I think, to recognize what that huge wealth that Jeff Bezos and Amazon have accumulated, what that's built on. In 2016, I went into an Amazon warehouse here in Britain. Before that, I mean, I used Amazon myself. It was kind of a first place I'd go to buy books or DVDs, say. I didn't really know much about what goes on in the warehouses. I kind of, like other people, I wouldn't say I idolized Jeff Bezos, but he was someone in the culture who was, you know, you had some respect for because he'd set up this organization that so many of us used. And while I went into the warehouse in 2016, I was really, really shocked by some of the things I saw there. I've worked in warehouses before this. It's not as if I was afraid of hard work or as if I'd never been in a kind of warehouse environment. But the atmosphere of the Amazon warehouse I worked in was what I imagine the atmosphere of a low security prison would feel like. This isn't an exaggeration. So, for example, we had to be drug and alcohol tested before we started work, which I'd never had to have that done before. We had to pass in and out of giant airport style security gates every time we even went to the toilet during the day. If you took a day off sick, you were given a disciplinary for that. And if you received six of these disciplinaries, you would effectively lose your job. And this was taking a day off sick, even if you had a letter from the doctor, even if you phoned in beforehand to say that you were going to be sick. So if you took 6 days off sick, you would effectively lose your job. And this was the biggest employer in this town. People were receiving disciplinaries for taking toilet breaks. The productivity targets were so high that workers were afraid to go to the bathroom. I mean, a survey came out of the Amazon warehouse I worked in recently, which found that 74% of order pickers were afraid to use the bathrooms because of the productivity targets.
James Bloodworth, on the productivity issue, the students in my class reported from their interviews that pickers were required to pick 300 items per hour from the various shelves in these huge warehouses. That comes to about one item every 12 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, it was astonishing. I mean, the first week I was working there, an Amazon supervisor came around to find me and told me that I was in the bottom 10% of productivity. And I'm someone who's relatively healthy. You know, I run, I go to the gym, I'm still reasonably young. And someone like me was, you know, at the bottom of the productivity pecking order. So imagine what it's like if you're older, if you're overweight at all, if you have a disability. It was just impossible to keep up with the targets. What happened was people were running around this huge warehouse, which is dangerous for a start. You also received a disciplinary for running. So to hit hit your targets. If you didn't hit your targets, you'd receive a disciplinary. But to hit your targets, you had to break the rules by running around, for which you'd receive another disciplinary. So what happened was you have this huge turnover of staff. No one's hanging on to their jobs because people are just being fired for anything. People are also leaving then before their full kind of employment rights kick in. So this is agency staff. We're all agency staff. And this turnover of staff, it's almost as if, you know, you can't prove it, but it's almost as if it's intentional. There's this, they try to get rid of you quite quickly because then they can bring more people in who don't have the same employment rights as a full-time employee.
You said you found urine bottles, people afraid to go to the bathroom to take time.
This has kind of blown up since the book came out, but it was something that I saw when I was working in the Amazon warehouse. So one day, one afternoon, walking around the top floor of this huge warehouse, and I found an empty Coca-Cola bottle with urine in it on the shelf. You know, yellow liquid, smelt it, it's very clear straight away what it is. There's a climate of fear, and you're afraid if you go to the toilet, which can take 5-10 minutes, you know, huge warehouse through security. People are being accused of taking so-called idle time for doing this. Everything which takes away from productivity at Amazon is seen as you're doing something wrong.
Blessed are the poor, for they shall endure. Ain't that for sure? I need a roof over my head. Yeah. Frustration out to kill me dead. And my table needs some bread. Believe me, let the hungry mouth be fed. Talking about food, clothes, and shelter. Let the turtle drink water. It's a fight against starvation, yeah. In malnutrition. So if the rates keep on down, press the poor, the willing farmer will reap no more, no, no more. So no more off your little trick, cause wealth and poverty just don't mix. Lord, talking about food, clothing, shelter. Let them turn to drink water. It's a fight against starvation, yeah. And malnutrition. Suffocation. What? Blessed are the poor, for this leisure. So Mr. Big, you get to understand. Don't do it ever, yeah.
States is a deeply religious country. A poll in 2016 by the Public Religion Research Institute found that nearly 70% of Americans identify as Christian, and about 45% say they attend church regularly. Of the rest, of course, there are myriad other religions, including Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, etc. There are constitutional protections for religious beliefs. And in fact, the idea of religious liberty has been deeply politicized by Trump's government and the American evangelical right wing.
But what about
the non-believers among us? Why, in a nation that also separates church from state, is there such an outsized representation of religion and protections of religious liberties? A new history book attempts to explore this question. Its co-author R. Lawrence Moore now joins me. He's a professor emeritus of history and American studies at Cornell University, and his co-author is Isaac Kramnik. The name of the book is Godless Citizens in a Godly Republic: Atheists in American Public Life. Welcome to the program, Larry. The history of the United States is very, very critical to this question of why there are so many protections for Christians and Christianity and religion and religious people in general, and so few for atheists. This was basically a country founded by people who were escaping religious persecution. Is that, in a nutshell, why we have such a deeply religious country today that protects religious views so much, or is it a lot more complicated than that?
Well, you know it's more complicated than that.
But that's why you wrote a book about it.
Yeah, and it's, of course, not just history. I mean, I want to say one thing right out that, you know, I taught American religious history for 40 years and wrote about it. And there is nothing in this book that is meant to be hostile to religion. It is simply a sort of bringing up to date the concept of non-belief, atheism, agnosticism, non-theism, whatever you want to call it, and putting it on an equal plane with everything else. Now, historically, it wasn't in the beginning for a lot of reasons, not only federal law, but mainly state law. And it goes back to colonia, it goes back to England, when people who did not believe in God were defined as non-trustworthy. You couldn't swear an oath to God. You couldn't be, you know, expected to tell the truth.
And I'm assuming blasphemy was a crime.
And blasphemy was a crime in England and in most of the American states. Now, that has changed to a considerable extent, but polls are difficult to sort of call and figure out numbers. But it is certainly true, and it's unambiguously true, that if you singled out a group that most Americans find untrustworthy when it comes to holding public office, people they said they would never vote for, they would vote for women, they would vote for homosexuals, they would vote for Muslims, they would vote for Mormons, other groups that have had some trouble, you know, with mainstream Protestant American. You know, agnostics and atheists far outweigh that prejudice. And it's odd, you know, because for one thing, the number of non-believers has grown tremendously in the past 20 years. So their numbers probably equal the number of so-called evangelicals, what you term the right-wing and evangelical movement. So they're not insignificant. And they also are heavily overrepresented in the professions and the academia. People who are truly creative among artists and writers and so on, their numbers are even more. So it's a little bit odd that this country, which is an advanced industrial society and prides itself on being well-educated, cannot come to grips with the fact that there's nothing dangerous about non-belief. It's simply what many people take to be their conviction, as seriously as any person takes religion, or theistic religion, to be serious. And the courts are beginning to recognize that. What isn't particularly being recognized is a lot of the cultural symbolism, our motto, In God We Trust. It used to be Pluribus Unum. That's a great slogan, out of many one. In God We Trust, it speaks to many people, but it doesn't speak to a significant minority. So it's divisive. It's not a great national motto. I'm sorry.
Right. In God we trust. And also, of course, when people are taking oaths of office, just the fact that they're to take an oath, and usually it's something that's done on a religious book, all of those things are encroachments of religion into the state against this idea that we have a separation of church and state. And of course, there is a protection of religious liberty in the Constitution. Much has been made of that, including the right of a baker to not bake a cake for a gay couple. But what about the fact that we do have a right to not believe, and our non-belief should not be held against us? You said there's a growing number of atheists in American society. Are they sort of disproportionately underrepresented in elected office because religion seems to be some sort of requirement for holding office?
A state constitution still, even though this has been struck down by the Supreme Court, have a provision in their constitutions that holders of any public office, even a justice of the peace, must believe in God.
Really?
Yeah, really. And wow. Those provisions are sort of null and void, but the states in question haven't removed them from the Constitution because it's sort of a political question. They've been asked to do that, but they haven't done it. Now, an atheist can run for public office anywhere. Whether an atheist wants to run for public office saying, hey, I don't believe in God, that's another question, because any political advisor would tell somebody, you know, if you want to run for public office, make some pretense of going to church or acting like you believe in God, and then it doesn't even matter that you're a moral rascal like...
He who shall not be named.
Yes, he who shall not be named, who has been endorsed by evangelical leaders and so on. It just boggles the mind. But in any case, someone who says straight out, I don't believe in God, you won't find many of those people in the American Congress. I think last time we looked, there were two, but in fact, there are many more. It's just they don't want to go on record as saying that. And, you know, that's part of our problem. What kind of a society we have when people aren't afraid of somehow, if they're running for public office, that they have to duck what they really believe? There's nothing wrong with being a non-believer. I mean, we're not bad people. We're not, you know, the child molesters are somewhere else. It's not us. There's nothing about non-belief that is allied with unethical behavior or criminal behavior or sexually deviant behavior. It's just a form of belief. And most of the, you know, non-believers I know are deeply, deeply ethical, moral people who think a whole lot about the difference between right and wrong and how to make the world a better place.
How does the U.S. compare to other democracies, other industrialized nations, even just in the West? European countries have very religious origins, have a deep cultural history rooted in religion. But in contemporary terms, how does the U.S. compare to European countries, say?
Well, one thing about Europe, of course, is their history is rooted in real religious warfare. I mean, you have to go back several centuries even before. So they spent a lot of time resolving that. And when they got beyond that, they still had a lot of laws that favored Catholicism and Christianity. And a lot of Europeans in the 19th century had to fight against established churches, powerful established churches, which at least you can say in the United States, we didn't. Not in the same way, anyway. So there was a lot of anti-clericism that developed in Europe as a result. And by the time you get to the end of the 19th century, a lot of people are declared agnostics, non-believers. And that's the way it's been ever since. And I like to say that in some ways, we're catching up with France, Italy, Spain, Ireland, even England, where, you know, religion as a matter of deep-seated conviction just hasn't been very important to the majority of the populations there. I suspect that's where we're headed.
And of course, one of the things that sets the U.S. apart is this bizarre role that evangelical Christians, especially in recent decades, have played in American politics, right? There was a concerted effort for evangelicals to become politically active and, you know, church leaders guiding their congregations on how to vote, etc. America is home to this phenomenon called mega churches that also have become often political tools in getting these massive congregations to vote on certain hot button issues like abortion or LGBT rights. Is that also something that makes the U.S. relatively unique?
Yes, it is. And what's interesting about these so-called mega churches, which are often, though not always, very politically active in a partisan way. I mean, there's no secret that their politics are deeply, deeply conservative, both on economic and social and cultural issues. So it's the Republican Party that has tried to tap into that kind of energy. It's been effective in certain elections. Politicians haven't given up on it. But what's interesting to me is if you sort of look at what happened, particularly to American Protestantism, the story of Catholicism is a little different, but these megachurches really destroy the traditional structures of American Protestant churches so that the well-known American Protestant congregations, with the exception of Southern Baptists, have much, much diminished roles in American life. They're tiny percentages of the population. So that weakened the sort of social action, not political action, social action of traditional Protestant churches. But the obvious political endorsement by evangelical leaders, which really dates back in a serious way to Ronald Reagan and Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority and so on, you know, that's also about the same time when you find young people in particular being turned off by religion. You know, there is a correlation between the rise of these politically active evangelical churches, which seem to be sometimes about anything except religion, and the number of people who are increasingly leaving churches and saying, you know, that's not for me. You know, if I want to be a politician, I'll join a political party and be politically active. I don't have to join some megachurch. These churches are in some ways shooting themselves in the foot, even though they still said double down on these elections that are coming up, the midterm elections. They're putting everything on Trump and Donald Trump supported candidate.
Give us a sense of some of the battles that took place in the early American history that ended up resulting in the sort of religious supremacy that we have today. We seem to be a conflicted nation on the one hand, wanting a separation of church and state and being proud of that to some extent, and on the other hand, really emphasizing religion and a requirement of religion. So what were some of the battles that took place?
Well, the first battle, of course, was the American Constitution, because getting the so-called religious clauses, the no religious test clause in the body of the American Constitution and the First Amendment passed, which was meant to put all religious groups and, you know, not necessarily excluding non-believers, by the way, on an equal footing. That was different than what existed in Europe at the time. So what turned out, of course, is that many of the founders who wrote the Constitution were deists. They weren't Christians. They believed in God, but they believed in a God who sort of had gone away and left the world to run itself and put their faith really in reason. Then in the beginning of the 19th century, there's all kinds of ironies that once churches were told you have to go out and find your own way in the world, the government is not going to give you money to build your churches or to pay the salaries of your ministers, then these churches started competing. And it was very successful business, so that Methodists and Baptists and Presbyterians, there is in the first part of the 19th century, really the first enormous churching of America. And for many immigrants coming into the country, churching was a way of finding one's identity, one's roots. It was a way of saying who you were in America, so that it's really interesting. And there's nothing in Europe, because Europe still had predominantly one religion. In many countries, that was Catholicism. In other countries, it was whatever the dominant Protestant church was, the Church of England, for example, in England. But in America, there was just wide open competition. And the wide open competition resulted in a lot of religious energy. It's fascinating, by the way. This is what sort of intrigues me about American history. And 19th century is really very different. So you have people invested in religion. So if you're left out of that, if you are an atheist or agnostic, you can fall afoul of blasphemy laws in the early part of the 19th century for saying something. You know, one of our favorite characters is Thomas Paine, who wrote documents that did as much as anybody to fuel the American Revolution. And he was very popular. You know, his books, you know, people still claim that some of Paine's writings sold as well as anything ever published in the United States. But then he also, after he spent some time in France, published The Age of Reason, which ridiculed biblical religion, ridiculed the Bible, ridiculed people who believed in the Bible. It's pretty funny reading. But he was reviled for that. He became a dirty, filthy atheist, and something like a dozen people attended his funeral, and people forgot about him for a long time. Another favorite example by me that has to do with feminism is Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Along with Susan B. Anthony, she, of course, you know, sort of the pinnacle of the early fight for women's rights, including the right to vote. But Elizabeth Cady Stanton, very early in her life, decided she didn't believe in God, she didn't believe in Christianity, and in fact went farther and decided that Christianity was really the real problem of women holding them down. And she said this. She said it publicly and loudly, and it wasn't a popular point of view in the women's movement.
You know that somebody on a dialysis machine in a cave didn't have NORAD stand down, didn't do war games and flying planes in the buildings that morning, didn't do CIA insider trading, didn't call Mayor Willie Brown and tell him not to fly and Ashcroft and everybody else.
What really happened on September 11th when 3,000 citizens were sent into heaven? Why the era fake Bin Laden video confession? Why's the fairy tale version got so many questions? Were radical hijackers that were only using box cutters sliced up pilots like a knife cutting hot butter? They had us frantic like a NASDAQ stock runner. They flew in planes like a Tom Cruise top gunner. But the story's bogus, I noticed. Dick Cheney ran 9/11 drinking Diet Sprite sodas. You only gotta look at how the buildings collapsed. Bombs popping off, listen, cause I'm building effects. A controlled demolition had a molten pool of steel up at ground zero. That's the temperature to drown heroes. Spies in the buildings that were oxygen starved. People waving from the windows where the bombing had started. So let me get this straight. These fires couldn't melt people to glass, but they could melt 47 steel frames. World Trade 7 wasn't hit by a plane. At 5 p.m. collapsed and they couldn't explain. Now for the third time in history, a steel building melted in a neat little pile. Had it happened, such a mystery. The owners said pull it and admitted they knew. That's Larry Silverstein, the partner with the Blackstone Group. They got the Echo crew and made $6 billion stacking blood money dripping off of necktie collars. The South Tower burned for like 48 minutes while the buildings in Madrid burned for 28 hours shooting white hot flames, but they never collapsed. Ask your scientist professor, make him try and explain that. But just watch the videos with concrete shooting out the blast point. You hear explosions at the flashpoint. C4 hit him like an asteroid. Planet a controlled demolition. Got a question you can ask Roy. You got a question you can ask Roy.
What you believe doesn't necessarily make it so. And so people say, well, how dare you, you know, change my reality on 9/11? I don't want to believe it. Well, regardless of what you believe, the facts are still the facts. Let me just say this.
Yo, for real, why was Dick Cheney running hijacking drills? And why is George Shultz got a mind that could kill? And why they steal the footage when a missile hit the Pentagon? Why they stay terror like in Beirut, Lebanon? Why is it the Lord never trying to intercept? Why would Rumsfeld stand out, order so direct? Really, why was 9/11 such an inside job? Well, because the facts make it easy to solve. So the project for the new American century said we need a mobilizer with a new Pearl Harbor. Yeah, we got him by the chains, but we need to pull harder in a cashless society controlled grid slaughter. So 3,000 citizens were martyred. The military budget seen jumping like a young Vince Carter. 9/11's really just a starter. They planted more terrorism all the way from here to Jakarta. And after the fact, they passed the Patriot Act. They left the Constitution murder with a stake in its back. Cause they had to get a stake in Iraq. Bechtel, Raytheon, DynCorp, and a Halliburton contracts. Children get abducted like alien contact. And I'm a great prison during military combat. Cheney's that man saying bomb that. I'm that vice president that played possum like a wombat. He stole the plan out of Operation Northwoods. Him and Scooter Libby burn crosses and they sport hoods. Peter Schumacher in a shadow government are running martial law takeover drills out of Fort Hood. See, they have poor goods. CIA running crack. Teenagers popping more Viking than Laura Bush. Deficit, they running up. $3 trillion missing from the Pentagon budget. The water supply is drugging it. Why you think they loving it, loving it? Got a system where the terrorism happens because the CIA funded it. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's just a one-legged shield. Bin Laden's already been killed. Just false flag, mind control, synthetic terrorism. Comic book villains, now Americans are scared of living blind to the 9/11 inside job. It's Roy Shivers to the truth like religion of God.
Face the facts, there's no debating it. All the evidence points toward David Ray Griffin's fourth scenario, government total involvement. That is a criminal element within the government. That doesn't mean your mailman was involved, or the cop was involved, or your cousin whose FBI was involved.
Yo, for real, why was Buzzy Crawdard selling airline stocks? Why is Bush's brain star where his hairline stops? Why the Pentagon officials all cancel the flights? Why does fluoridated water cause cancer in mice? Why did World Trade 7 all of a sudden collapse? Why was Dick Cheney planning for a war in Iraq? Really, why was 9/11 such an inside job? Well, because the facts make it easy to solve. Muhammad Atta trained as a spy up in Cali for the Able Danger program in the Monterey Valley. Then he transferred to a CIA flight school in Venice. FBI double agent terrorist apprentice with Cheney running drills like a dentist. Right. Remote control piloted and crashed into the World Trade Centers. And now he's claiming that he can defend us. Halliburton's making $20 billion off of genocide agendas. Economy to topple like Jenga. Mass media that's running bigger scams than the credit card lenders. This new world order that we enter is David Rockefeller's wet dream because he's chicken like tenders. It's really not the end of it. The Federal Reserve print money and they spending it. It's Roy Shivers. I can smell a psyop from the sentiment. Knowing that the NSA ran at least 80% of it. They knocked down the towers like a tenement, ensuring that the military industrial complex benefit. You hear the truth in my sentiment.
Nation officials that take reality and bended it.
It's called covert action. It's called compartmentalization. This is what they do. The CIA admits to hundreds of bombings all over the world to blame it on people.
Why supposed hijackers traded Air Force bases? And why did Flight 93 land in two places? And why did they replace it with a drone? And why a Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Pearl talking with Sharon? Why did agents from Assad lab and videotape? Why did FBI agents go and let him escape? Really, why was 9/11 such an inside job? Well, because the facts make it easy to solve.
I have official government documents for 9/11. I have official government documents for Operation Gladio. I have official government documents where they carried attacks out. Do you understand?
It is not difficult to see that the official account of the World Trade Center cannot be true. According to the official account, the Twin Towers came down because of the impact of the airplanes and the resulting fires. This is the account given by NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology. NIST is an agency of the Commerce Department and is thereby presently an agency of the Bush-Cheney administration. This administration is notorious for distorting science for political purposes. As a document signed by several thousand scientists, including many Nobel laureates, has charged. Such distortion runs throughout the NIST report on the Twin Towers. NIST claims that explosives played no role in the destruction of the towers, but the evidence clearly suggests otherwise. First, steel frame high-rise buildings have never collapsed except when they have been brought down by explosives in the process known as controlled demolition. Therefore, the natural hypothesis, the scientific hypothesis, would have been that explosives were what brought the towers down. But NIST refused to consider this hypothesis. Second, at least 200 people, including over 100 members of the Fire Department of New York, reported evidence of explosions in the towers. For example, Fire Department Captain Dennis Tardillo said, "I hear an explosion and I look up. It is as if the building is being imploded from the top floor down, one after another. Boom, boom, boom." Wall Street Journal John Bussey said, "I looked out of the office window to see what seemed like perfectly synchronized explosions coming from each floor, one after the other, from top to bottom, with a fraction of a second between. The floors blew to pieces." I could fill this whole lecture with such testimonies, but NIST simply ignored them. Third, the towers did not merely collapse. They disintegrated. The top floors exploded. The explosions were so powerful that steel beams were thrown out 400-500 feet. Some of them were plastered onto neighboring buildings, as you can see in videos such as 9/11 Mysteries and Loose Change Final Cut. Gravity pulls things straight down. Only very powerful explosives could have caused these horizontal ejections. Fourth, after these explosions, the towers came straight down at virtually free fall speed. This means that the bottom floors were offering no resistance to the material above them. And yet each tower had been supported by 287 steel columns, 240 columns around the periphery, and 47 massive steel columns in the core. For the building to come straight down, to have a symmetrical collapse, all 280 columns had to fail simultaneously. That's what explosives do in controlled implosions. It is not something that fire can do. Fifth, virtually all the concrete and everything else except the steel was pulverized into tiny particles. According to NIST, fire and gravitation were the only sources of energy beyond the impact of the airplanes. Fire and gravitation could not have caused such pulverization. What do experts say? Listen to the words of internationally known architect David A. Johnson. "As a professional city planner in New York, I knew those buildings and their design. So I was well aware of the strength of the core with its steel columns. When I saw the rapid collapse of the towers, I knew that they could not come down the way they did without explosives and the severing of core columns at the base. The spewing of debris from the towers where the planes entered also could not have occurred simply with just a structural collapse. Moreover, the symmetrical collapse is strong evidence of controlled demolition. A building falling from asymmetrical structural failure would not collapse so neatly nor so rapidly. The official explanation doesn't hold water." Dr. Johnson, moreover, is simply one of some 200 architects and engineers who, by joining a new organization called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, have publicly announced their rejection of the official story. What about Building 7 of the World Trade Center? The falsity of the official count of it is even more obvious. This building was not hit by a plane and had only a little external damage and fires on only a few floors, resulting, we are told, from debris from the collapse of the towers. And yet this 47-story building completely collapsed at 5:20 in about 7 seconds. Explosions in the building were reported by several people, including two city officials. The collapse of this building exemplified all the standard features of controlled implosion. Any expert looking at the video can immediately tell what happened. In 2006, Danny Jowinkel, a demolition expert in the Netherlands, who had not known that Building 7 had collapsed on 9/11, was shown videos of the collapse. The interviewer, without telling him what it was, asked him what he saw. Jowinkel said, "It starts from below. They have simply blown away columns. A team of experts did this. This is controlled demolition." When he was told that this building also collapsed on September 11th, he was incredulous, asking repeatedly, "Are you sure? Are you sure?" After Jowinkel was finally convinced and had examined the evidence more extensively, he said, "This is professional work, without any doubt." Architect Richard Gage, who founded Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, says that there is very clear evidence that all three World Trade Center high-rise buildings were destroyed not by fire, as our government says, but by controlled demolition with explosives. Once this is clear, the idea that the attacks were orchestrated and carried out by foreign terrorists becomes implausible. Foreign terrorists surely would not have had the courtesy to make sure the buildings came straight down rather than falling over, so they would have destroyed dozens of other buildings in Lower Manhattan. Also, foreign terrorists could have not gotten access to the buildings for all the hours needed to plant explosives. If one is wondering how homegrown terrorists could have gotten such access, a clue might be provided by the fact that Marvin Bush, the president's brother, was one of the principals of a company that handles security for the World Trade Center. But do we not know that Osama bin Laden was responsible for the attacks? Nothing is more basic to the official story. However, although Colin Powell, when he was Secretary of State, promised to provide proof of bin Laden's responsibility, this promise was quickly withdrawn and the proof was never provided. That, of course, was 2001. Surely by now, we would suppose, the FBI would have a massive amount of evidence of bin Laden's guilt. However, when one turns to the FBI's page on bin Laden as a most wanted terrorist, you will find that 9/11 is not listed as one of the terrorist attacks for which he is wanted. When Rex Toom, the FBI's chief of investigative publicity, was asked why not, he said, "Because the FBI has no hard evidence connecting bin Laden to 9/11. But surely, one might respond, even if there's no proof that bin Laden himself was involved, there were many kinds of evidence that the planes were hijacked by members of Al-Qaeda. When this evidence is examined, however, it quickly dissolves. One proof provided was that the passports of some of the hijackers were found. A week after 9/11, the FBI reported that the passport of one of the hijackers who crashed the plane into the North Tower had been found in the street a few days earlier. We are supposed to believe, in other words, that after one of the airliners hit the tower, creating a fiery inferno, and after the tower exploded, pulverizing virtually everything into concrete and dust, one of the passports floated to the ground. This story was subjected to some ridicule in the press. It was later changed. According to the 9/11 Commission, a staff report, a passerby picked it up shortly before the World Trade Center towers collapsed. This version, according to which the passport had to escape only from the plane and then survive the fiery inferno, was evidently thought to be more plausible. Even more absurd was the claim that two passports of hijackers on United 93 were found at the crash site in Pennsylvania. At least it was supposed to be the crash site. Everyone who went there said there was no sign of a plane. The official explanation for this fact was that the hijacker pilot had flown the plane downward at 580 miles an hour. When it hit the soft Pennsylvania soil, it went completely into the ground so that not even the tail section was visible. Nevertheless, we are told, the authorities found two of the hijackers' passports. Actually, you know, maybe this is believable because, you know, when we're flying along at 580 miles an hour, we often leave the window open and things fly out. Given the implausibility of these claims, we cannot use the passports as evidence that there were hijackers on the planes. However, the main evidence for hijackers was phone calls from the planes, in which passengers on the airliners reported that their planes had been hijacked. Many of these calls, especially from United 93, were believed to have been made on cell phones. Dina Burnett, for example, reported that she had received 4 phone calls from her husband, Tom Burnett. He had used his cell phone, she knew, because she recognized his number on her cell phone's caller ID. She reported this to reporters, on TV shows, and in a book. In 2006, however, at the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, the FBI presented a report on phone calls from all the airliners. According to this report, there were only 2 cell phone calls from United 93, and one of these was from a passenger who called 911, and one was from a flight attendant. Both of these calls were reportedly made shortly before the plane crashed, when it was down to 5,000 feet. This is significant because most of the cell phone calls were reportedly made when the flight was at 30,000 or even 40,000 feet. And there had long been an ongoing debate about whether cell phones from airliners were possible at such high altitudes. Members of the 9/11 Truth Movement had said, no, they're not. So it is significant that when the FBI had to present testimony in a court of law, it did not claim that any high-altitude cell phone calls were made, whether from that flight or any of the others. In any case, the FBI report indicated that Dina Burnett did not receive any cell phone calls from her husband. What do we do about her statement that she saw his cell phone number on her caller ID? Must we say that she's lying? No. The probable answer, I have argued, is that she and the others were duped. The calls were faked. The technology of voice morphing had been sufficiently developed prior to 2001 to fool people's best friends, even their spouses. And there are devices that will fake other people's phone numbers as well as their voices. This conclusion that the calls were faked is strengthened by evidence from some of the reported conversations that show that they were not genuine. For example, when Mark Bingham's mother answered the phone, the caller said, "Mom, this is Mark Bingham." In any case, if the reported cell phone calls were faked, as the FBI report indicates they must have been, we must conclude that all the reported calls from the airliners were faked, including those from airphones. Once examined, all the other purported evidence for hijackers dissolves. This does not mean, to be sure, that the men charged with hijacking the planes did not exist. There really were men going by those names. But did they fit the official story's portrait of them as devout Muslims who, being ready to meet their maker and collect their heavenly reward, had no reluctance to commit suicide? Let us look in particular at Muhammad Atta, said to have been the ringleader. According to the 9/11 Commission report, Atta had become very religious, even fanatically so. According to a letter that authorities claim was written by Atta, he said he planned to kill himself so that he could go to heaven as a martyr. But when we look at the actual behavior of Muhammad Atta, at least the man going by this name, we see something very different. Atta drank lots of alcohol, took cocaine, went to strip joints. He even lived with an exotic dancer for a couple months early in 2001. The government and the 9/11 Commission went to great lengths to cover up these facts, and for good reason. As a professor of Muslim studies said, "It is incomprehensible that a person could drink and go to a strip bar one night, then kill themselves the next day in the name of Islam. Something here does not add up." What role did Atta and the others play in the operation? Were they hired to play this role? We will probably not know until there is a real investigation. We know enough, however, to say that the 9/11 attacks were not orchestrated or even assisted by devout Muslims. This conclusion is strengthened by some problems in the official story of the attack on the Pentagon. Although there are lots of these problems, I will here limit myself to 2. According to the official story, the Pentagon was struck by American Flight 77 under the control of hijacker Hani Hanyur. Numerous reports had indicated, however, that Hanyur was a terrible pilot who could not even safely fly a single-engine airplane. As one flight instructor quoted by the New York Times put it, he could not fly at all. And yet the plane that hit the Pentagon, according to the official story, was flown with military precision. After completing a 333 downward spiral, it came in at ground level to hit the Pentagon between the first and the second floors and did this without even scratching the Pentagon lawn. The Washington Post wrote, "Aviation sources say the plane was flown with extraordinary skill, making it highly likely that a trained pilot was at the helm. Hani Hanjour, who could barely fly a Cessna, could not have done this in a Boeing 757. As Ralph Omholt, a former 757 pilot, has said, "The idea that an unskilled pilot could have flown this trajectory is simply too ridiculous to consider." If you check out Pilots for 9/11 Truth, you'll see that there are lots of other pilots who agree. The most well-known report about hijackers on planes came from Ted Olson, who was the Department of Justice's Solicitor General. He told CNN on the afternoon of 9/11 that his wife, the well-known CNN commentator Barbara Olson, had called him twice from American Airlines Flight 77, the flight that reportedly hit the Pentagon, and told him that hijackers armed with knives and box cutters had taken over the plane. This claim played some vital roles. Besides telling the world that Flight 77 had been hijacked, it provided the only evidence that this plane was still aloft. It had disappeared from radar in the Midwest, and there were reports that an airliner in that area had crashed. So the reported calls from Barbara Olson provided evidence that the Pentagon really was, as the government claimed, struck by American Flight 77. However, Ted Olson's story is highly problematic. One problem was that he went back and forth on whether she had used a cell phone or an onboard phone. He finally settled on the latter, thereby avoiding the problem of whether a cell phone call would have been possible. In 2006, however, an American airline representative, in response to a query from a member of the 9/11 Truth movement, said, "We do not have phones on our Boeing 757. The passengers on Flight 77 used their own personal cellular phones to make out calls during the terrorist attack." Ted Olson's claim was even further undermined by the report presented by the FBI at the Moussaoui trial. According to this report, the only call attempted by Barbara Olson was unconnected, and it lasted, therefore, 0 seconds. This is an amazing development. The FBI is part of the Department of Justice, and yet it failed to support the claim by the former Solicitor General of this department to have received 2 phone calls from his wife on the morning of 9/11. In doing so, the FBI undermined the only evidence that Flight 77 was hijacked and flown back to Washington. There are lots of other problems in the official story about the Pentagon strike, but these two, involving Hani Hanjour and Barbara Olson, provide all we need to know to conclude that the story is not true. I have now discussed some of the evidence pointing to the conclusion that 9/11 was a false flag operation perpetrated by forces within our own government. There is far more evidence, as I have shown in my recent book, Debunking 9/11 Debunking. But what I have summarized here should be sufficient for those with eyes to see that the official story is, at the very least, deeply problematic. Not everyone, however, has eyes to see. For example, Jim Dwyer wrote a New York Times story entitled, "Two U.S. Reports Seek to Counter Conspiracy Theories About 9/11. A more accurate title would have been, "Two U.S. Reports Say Government's Conspiracy Theory is Better Than Alternative Conspiracy Theory." But the Times would never have used any such headline. This one-sided use of the term does not occur only in the mainstream media. It is just as prevalent on the left. For example, Salim Muwakkil, a senior editor of In These Times, wrote in 2005, "The 9/11 movement caught my attention when I saw Dr. David Ray Griffin speaking at the University of Wisconsin at Madison on C-SPAN earlier this year. Griffin has written several well-regarded books on religion and spirituality and is considered one of the nation's foremost theologians. I regard him as a wise writer on the role of spirituality in society. So it was shocking to see him pushing a radical conspiracy theory about 9/11 on C-SPAN. What could have transformed this sober, reflective scholar into a conspiracy theorist?" I, of course, had been a conspiracy theorist all along. The only thing that changed was that in 2003, I rejected the official conspiracy theory in favor of the alternative one. From the point of In These Times, however, that was when I first became a conspiracy theorist, leading the magazine to ask, what happened to Griffin? Another writer for the magazine, Terry Allen, answered, I think part of it is that he's a theologian who operates on faith. My own answer, that I finally looked at the evidence, was evidently ruled out a priori, because there could be no good evidence for a conspiracy theory. These two writers seemed also completely innocent of the fact that they rejected my conspiracy theory on the basis of faith, faith in the national myth. These two examples, in any case, show how the term conspiracy theory is used in this discussion. It is not used in the generic sense to mean any secret agreement to do something illegal. It is used for a theory alleging that our own government did something not only illegal, but so terrible as to contradict our faith in our nation's basic goodness. The fact that such theories are not to be seriously entertained in public discourse was made clear by President Bush in his address to the United Nations 2 months after 9/11. He said,
"Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
Malicious lies that attempt to shift the blame away from the terrorists. What would an outrageous conspiracy theory be? If we were operating in a philosophy of science context, the answer would be clear. A good theory is a theory that can account for all the relevant evidence in a coherent way. A bad theory is one that is contradicted by some of the relevant evidence. An outrageous theory would be one that is contradicted by virtually all the relevant evidence. From that standard, it's clear that the official theory about 9/11 is the outrageous conspiracy theory. But the public discussion of 9/11 does not occur in a philosophy of science context. It occurs in a political context. And in this context, the alternative theory is the outrageous one by definition, because it says members of the Bush administration ordered it, not Osama bin Laden. Evidence has nothing to do with what is outrageous. In warning people not to tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories, Bush was reminding people, especially people who control the mainstream media, that anyone saying that 9/11 was an inside job was not to be given a sympathetic or even a neutral hearing. This injunction has been obeyed.
We've been fighting a long time. We are outnumbered by machines. Humans have a strength that cannot be measured. This is John Connor. If you're listening to this, you are the resistance.
Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing took a dramatic turn Thursday when Democratic senators began releasing confidential documents from Kavanaugh's work at the George W. Bush White House. The move came in response to the Trump administration withholding more than 100,000 pages of Kavanaugh's records on the basis of presidential privilege. The Democrats' move came shortly after the New York Times broke a major story Thursday morning, revealing Kavanaugh as a White House attorney wrote in 2003, he did not deem the Supreme Court's landmark Roe v. Wade abortion rights decision to be settled law of the land. Kavanaugh wrote, quote, I am not sure that all legal scholars refer to Roe as the settled law of the land at the Supreme Court level, since court can always overrule its precedent, and three current justices on the court would do so, he said. Go to Senator Kamala Harris of California, questioning Kavanaugh on Wednesday about whether he discussed the Mueller investigation with anyone at Kasowitz Benson Torres law firm, Mark Kasowitz, the personal attorney for Donald Trump.
Did you talk with anyone at Kasowitz Benson and Torres?
You asked me that. I need to know who works there.
I think you can answer the question without me giving you a list of all employees of that law firm.
Well, actually, I can't.
Why not?
Because I don't know who works there.
So that's the only way you would know who you spoke with? I want to understand your response to my question, because it's a very direct one. Did you speak with anyone at that law firm about the Mueller investigation? It's a very direct question.
Right. I'd be surprised, but I don't know anyone. I don't know if the I don't know everyone who works at that law firm. So I just want to be careful, because your question was and or. So I want to be very literal.
That's fine. I'll ask a more direct question if that's helpful to you. Did you speak with anyone at that law firm about Bob Mueller's investigation?
I'm not remembering anything like that, but I want to know a roster of people, and I want to know more.
So you're not denying that you spoke with
him? Well, I said I don't remember anything like that.
So that was Judge Kavanaugh Wednesday. Senator Harris on Thursday again asked Kavanaugh if he discussed the Mueller investigation with anyone at Kasowitz Benson Torres law firm. What is the point that Senator Harris is making?
Look, we need justices on our nation's highest court who will be truthful, of the highest integrity. Justices where there is no question about their veracity and their ability to always be forthcoming and honest. And I must say that it was painful listening to Senator Harris ask very clear questions about Kavanaugh and his contacts with lawyers from that firm. At every turn, he just seemed to be incredibly evasive.
You, a party to a conversation that occurred regarding Special Counsel Mueller's investigation, and a simple yes or no would suffice.
About his investigation. And are you referring to a specific person?
I'm referring to a specific subject, and the specific person I'm referring to is you.
Now, who was the conversation with? You said you had information.
That is not the subject of the question, sir. The okay. subject of the question is you and whether you were part of a conversation regarding Special Counsel Mueller's investigation.
The answer is no.
If you can explain why she is asking this question, this whole issue of Kavanaugh was not on the Federalist Society list of judges to choose from for the Supreme Court, as was Gorsuch. And Trump made very clear, this is the only list I will use. And this issue that came up, that Kavanaugh was added after the Mueller investigation began, and was he speaking with Trump's personal lawyer?
Explain.
It raises important questions. I mean, he did not show up on President Trump's first or second short list in which the president claimed that he was airing to the public all of the people he was considering for this most important position. You know, when we look at the trajectory of what he was doing during that time period, it's almost as if he were auditioning for the role. I mean, he's out giving speeches to the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation and law schools where he's airing his views about Justice Rehnquist, who issued the dissenting opinion in Roe v. Wade and how much he deems him a hero. He's talking about executive power. It's almost as if he were auditioning for the president. And I think that the president selected him in part because he finds comfort in Kavanaugh's current views and outlook on executive power and presidential privilege. And again, you know, Senator Harris really, I think, was getting to his ability to be truthful, which is perhaps the most important characteristic.
This one's called Truth Be Denied. Don't see the good in the area.
I've had a few dealings in the city, met a number of stockbrokers, and I can tell you, in all my life, I've never seen such dishonesty and greed. Like a big betting shop, a bookies, a casino, where they're all screwing each other and the rest of the world.
The devil is here in the city, and the city wakes up with the devil. The devil is here in the city.
From Jamaica, Style Scott. Drums.
Every book that I've written has a kind of template. For instance, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which I did with the great cartoonist Joe Sacco, one of the finest journalists in America. And if you have not read Footnotes in Gaza, which he spent 6 years on, it's a masterpiece on the Israel-Palestine conflict. I knew it was going to be a rough one to go through, and I got up. I actually got up Easter morning before everyone in my house was awake so that it would be still and quiet, and that book just reduced me to tears. That book was really modeled on Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, the great work by James Agee, and the photographs by Walker Evans. This book, my kind of model was Emil Durkheim's great study of suicide at the end of the 19th century in France, where Durkheim, who was an amazing sociologist, very much like W.E.B. Du Bois, where he would go out. He didn't remain trapped in his particular academic enclave, but really went out and listened and interviewed, which is, of course, what made Du Bois such a remarkable and important presence and sociologist within the United States, writing about African-American communities. He came to the conclusion, this is where we get the term anomy, that societies that disintegrate, societies in decay, communities in decay, create diseases of despair. That's not his term, but that's his idea. Pathologies that are expressed, that rise up from failed states. And those would be self-loathing, a sense of a lack of self-worth, alienation, all, as Durkheim says, that comes when you no longer have faith or belief in the established order, the established ideology, and established institutions. Those kinds of pathologies are expressed in very self-destructive activities. Gambling, hate crimes, sexual sadism, which is what pornography is, although I went to the extreme. In my book, Empire of Illusion, I had written about the porn industry, but for this book, I went to kink.com. Hopefully none of you know what it is. I didn't know what it is. Derek Jensen had to tell me what it was. So they bought the old National Guard armory in San Francisco and run the largest BDSM operation in the world, which is live streamed. It is torture. It is clearly, I mean, women are waterboarded and stuff. And then people can stream in and say what they want done to the women. I mean, just appalling. But anyway, I went to these classes, which were held in the basement of the armory for doms. There are dweeby guys who dress in black, and me, sitting in the basement. I was not dressed in black. I actually wrote the gambling chapter out of the Trump Taj Mahal before I even knew Trump was even going to announce, which was an inappropriate decay. I mean, there was mice all over the place, the lights were burned out, and people were shooting up in the elevators, and most of the Taj Mahal was mothballed. It gives a nice picture of what's going to happen to the rest of the country if he remains in power. And then I was with these white hate groups, Knights of the Alt-Right, Proud Boys, which, of course, hate groups are a product of a diseased society, the 3%ers. I was actually at one point at night around a bonfire with these guys in upstate New York, of course, living in mortal fear that someone there would Google me. I was with my research assistant, who was terrified, quite justifiably so. And at one point, across the bonfire in the dusk, we saw two or three of these guys pointing at me. That's when, like, we got out. When we got to the car, she was so frightened, she, like, crawled down to the floor. And their counterpart on the left, and I've been very critical, as some of you may know, of the Black Bloc and Antifa for much the same reason. I was in these deindustrialized pockets, Anderson, Indiana. One of the things I like as a writer, I enjoy reporting. I like it because when I go out, it often shatters my own assumptions about what is happening. I mean, it keeps me intellectually honest. So sometimes, you know, I can go into a subject and think that I have a great body of knowledge. I wrote a book on the Christian right, which has become, unfortunately, I think, fairly relevant to our particular political situation. It's called American Fascists, the Christian Right and the War on America. I was trying to reach out to them. I come out of the liberal church. My father was a Presbyterian minister, of course, as you heard. I'm a graduate of Harvard Divinity School. But I didn't really know much about the Christian right. And I went in there with all sorts of assumptions, and I would say even stereotypes about the kinds of people who embrace this form of fundamentalism, which I think is heretical. It's Christian heresy. But I couldn't listen to these stories of dislocation and pain, sexual, domestic abuse, struggles with addictions, evictions, bankruptcies, without having it break my heart. And I rewrote the whole book. The first chapter is called Despair, and it drove home to me what despair does. One of the great studies of the rise of fascism by Fritz Stern is called The Politics of Cultural Despair in the Origins of Totalitarianism, holds up despair. Again, I think going back to Durkheim, that sense of worthlessness, that sense, and it propels people into a kind of magical thinking. I also, in the book, was with preppers and survivalists in Utah who have a little food in their bunker and a lot of ammunition. But I think that magical thinking, anthropologists call it crisis cults, is a natural response to people who are just so overwhelmed by reality that they can't cope. So Anderson, Indiana used to have most of the big GM plants. And then Clinton gave the gift of NAFTA to the American working class, and GM hightailed it down to Monterey Mexico, where they pay workers without any benefits or job security $3 an hour. So if you were a senior level overtime, you know, you could be making $50 an hour. You had benefits. You had a pension plan. You were medically covered. You were in the UAW. You had job security. It's all vanished. Anderson went into the kind of tailspin that many deindustrialized pockets of the United States went into, with all of the attendant problems, including, of course, the rise of a casino, like this whole idea of economic development through gambling. I watched that work try to work in Yugoslavia, and it doesn't come to a good end. The idea that you're going to fill state revenue shortfalls with gambling. I mean, what was fascinating about Anderson is that most of these old UAW workers voted for Bernie Sanders. But when the general election came around, they voted for Trump because they weren't going to vote for Clinton after NAFTA. They were acutely aware, and perhaps their anger was even greater at the Democratic Party than the Republican Party, because it was the Democratic Party that had betrayed them, that had pretended to fight for their interests and their concerns, that continued to use the feel your pain language of traditional liberalism, but it thrust a knife in their back. And that betrayal is very dangerous. When James Baldwin writes about, in one of his essays, he writes about why he thinks African-American middle-aged men don't have a midlife crisis the way white middle-aged men do. He said, because African-American men are not prone to believe in the American dream, given the forms of oppression that mutate and are protean and have always existed throughout American history.
We'll be right back. Wit Radio. Social media on the air.
Free Speech Radio.
Responsible anarchy.
I do not have attention deficit disorder. I have surplus attention capacity syndrome.
Security, cinema, and the military entertainment state. Are we ready?
I'm ready. Let's go.
Go ahead.
Round one.
The category is weaponizing the public mind. For 200 points, give a heavily redacted answer to this question. What is the difference between censorship and propaganda?
Between what?
Repeat the question, please.
The difference between censorship and propaganda. What is it?
There is no difference.
Wrong.
Propaganda is false. Censorship is bull bleep.
Getting warmer.
The difference between censorship and propaganda is the difference between George Orwell and Oliver Stone.
We have a winner.
Hooray!
Hooray for me.
But I love Oliver Stone.
Our greatest film director.
Stone's critics dismiss him as an established propagandist posing as a dissident. Nixon was a great movie.
There was nothing great about Nixon.
Oliver Stone made a biopic about Nixon that deleted Prescott Bush from Nixon's life. Oliver Stone is a genius.
I am talking with representatives of the Pentagon Film Office about secret propaganda operations in Hollywood. Is Ben Affleck CIA?
No names, please.
Yes, he is, but not on the record.
Each week, we drug our guests with truth serum to simulate the conversation.
When a producer asks for government cooperation on a major film project, we require certain script changes.
So is Oliver Stone in the tank?
Oliver Stone is a great because he is in the tank.
Can you prove that?
Nah, we already said too much.
More tea.
Thank you. The truth is, all movies are propaganda movies.
For instance, if the hero of a big-budget war movie is killed before the movie ends, then the technical term is, it's a flop. But if the hero survives, it's a blockbuster, which is why Hollywood will never produce Orwell's 1984. In the final reel, the hero gets whacked.
A big mistake. In the Broadway play version of 1984, the hero survives.
1984 is on Broadway?
Impossible.
Who's going to pay to see a Broadway play about torture? The hero gets whacked in the end.
In the Broadway version of 1984, Winston Smith doesn't get whacked. He survives. Yeah, they rewrote the ending of 1984. In the novel, Winston Smith is assassinated. He gets a bullet in the back of his head, but not on Broadway. Winston is not killed by a bullet to the back of his head.
But that changes the author's intent.
It changes everything.
Winston is killed, or I want my money back.
Well, it's like 1984, but without having to be 1984.
Literary rape is what it is.
Why, thank you.
You brag about defacing great works of literature?
Orwell was a hack.
Every generation rewrites history.
Mind control?
Every generation does it.
You can't tell me what to think.
We don't have to. Great Hollywood films do it better.
What do you consider a great Hollywood movie?
Oh wait, I know this.
Repeat the question.
What do you consider to be a great Hollywood movie?
Oliver Stone's World Trade Center.
Wrong.
Oliver Stone's Snowden.
Wrong.
Oliver Stone's W.
We have a tie. Everyone loses.
Oh.
The answer is Oliver Stone's Nixon. Roll the clip.
We are all affected by this.
I am one of the most knowledgeable people around when it comes to entertainment propaganda, but I'm still influenced by this in ways I'm probably not even conscious of, let alone able to counteract. So for people completely unaware of the massive government propaganda machine, they have no real defense against this. These films play a vital role in maintaining support for the military and CIA and government in general, or at least dampening criticism and opposition to them. So I put it to you that the Pentagon sees Hollywood as just another information space to be conquered. They are particularly protective of details on how they change the scripts and contents of films. In recent years, the Pentagon have not only expanded their operations in the entertainment industry, they have aggressively and proactively tried to expand their influence on Hollywood and get involved at the earliest stages of production. And the Pentagon gets one over on film producers by rewriting their scripts. The producers don't say a word. I literally cannot think of anyone from inside the movie industry who has complained to the media about the creative compromises they have to make to get military support. What's really going on?
The voice is Tom Secker. I'm Kid. This is Twit Wit Radio. Half true, more or less 100% of the time.
Ask me anything.
We have been talking with representatives of the entertainment state who prefer to remain anonymous. Swing voter has a question.
Go ahead.
Does Hollywood hate America?
Not my Hollywood.
Oh, do you live in Disneyland?
Eventually. We'll all live there.
You're getting on my nerves, lady.
Hey, she's trying to tell us something.
Well, just say it.
All spies are trained to lie. Well, Edward Snowden is a trained CIA agent. He was taught how to lie to enemies, to friends, to the press. It's what undercover agents do.
How did you discover this?
I have a band, Smart Alex and the Whistleblowers.
Where do you get your funding?
At the merch table after the show.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I want to make a documentary about the cultural enslavement happening from the CIA. I need the Pentagon Film Office to give me access to the Afghanistan poppy fields.
Huh.
We might suggest a script change.
Change poppy fields to tulip bulbs, and we'll consider it.
How much are we talking about?
The cost of your soul.
Well, I need government funding for my movie so I can expose government corruption. If I have to censor my script to get the story out, what have I accomplished?
You've accomplished a brilliant career move.
The Pentagon Film Office works closely with all the major film directors to ensure authenticity and accuracy when depicting our great national cultural debasement.
Our great national narrative.
Why are young audiences so ungrateful? I mean, when I was your age...
You had sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and you didn't think to leave any for us.
Without censorship, the Empire would collapse into its footprint, like Building 7.
Building what?
Zero Dark 30. Normalized torture.
Okay, and why is it so hard to get real butter on my popcorn? That's all I ask.
They're just movies. What's the big deal?
No, they are not just movies.
You can't convince me that the director who made JFK also made W and World Trade Center and Snowden.
But he did.
W, World Trade Center, and Snowden share similar themes and messages.
What message?
9/11 was an Islam job.
Is that what you think?
What I think doesn't matter.
Everybody finds out about it sometime.
Finds out what?
Roll the clip.
In August 2010, the Army met with agents from William Morris Endeavor, one of the largest talent agencies in Hollywood. The purpose was for the DOD to find out how to better align U.S. Army interests with feature films. The explicit goal of the DOD is to enter studio projects early in the development stages, where characters and storylines are most easily shaped to the Army's benefit. Our meetings with the head of production for the Group of Eight, the eight largest studios in Hollywood, Andy Davis, the president of production administration at Columbia Pictures, the scripted and unscripted production team at TNT, TBS, and even small independent outfits show how eager the DoD are to get upstream in the creative process. Another example is a pair of meetings involving Warner Brothers Studio in September and November 2012, where military officials met with production executives so they could get involved early in the production timeline on potential projects and programs, so we can help shape the topics before they are finalized by the studio executives. The DoD is not just assisting with films and TV shows as early as the pre-production stage, but is also seeking to be involved in the process by which studio executives choose which scripts to produce or not produce. It does help explain how our popular culture remains so militaristic, even at a time when people are relatively sick of war and don't see any purpose in most of our foreign policy.
The voice is Tom Secker. I'm Brooklyn Kidd. We are talking with...
No names, please.
At the Pentagon Film Office, we no longer deny it.
Censorship and propaganda are patriotic expressions of our cherished democratic values.
Can you please be more specific?
Absolutely not.
No way. I can't take questions.
Yeah. Does anyone on the panel have a question for our unnamed guests?
Yeah. Why hasn't Oliver Stone made a movie about the assassination of Martin Luther King?
Next question.
I can answer that. Political assassinations are just too complex for audiences to follow. Look at what happened with JFK.
Hold on. What happened with JFK?
Oh, I saw that movie, but I can't tell you who pulled the trigger.
The actual gunman was never identified.
There was more than one gunman.
Oh, does it really matter? Presidents are not really in charge of anything.
So, is democracy a hoax?
How long have you been a security risk?
Well, how did you find out?
A lucky guess.
Are you a trained liar or just natural talent?
Pass.
The public wants to be lied to.
That's a bold-faced lie.
The magic bullet theory is a bold-faced lie.
The public wants magic in their lives.
The public wants 5-cent beers served in drive-thru restaurants.
There were so many suspects, I couldn't keep track. Like, was Jack Ruby a stripper or wasn't he?
What do you want to know?
Well, I want to know if I have any secrets.
Yes, of course. They're safely stored on a National Security State Service.
Well, are you reading my text messages?
You've been in communication with a conspiracy theorist who thinks that Oliver Stone is in the tank.
Well, that was sent to me unsolicited. I don't believe it.
You left a comment.
I was drunk at the time.
What was the comment?
I quote, "What was George H.W. Bush doing in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963?
I asked him. He said he can't remember where he was that day. Change the subject.
Vladimir Putin and Oliver Stone are in love. They have a baby girl.
Who's the father?
Military intelligence.
DARPA.
I am way out of the loop.
Oswald was a fake defector. He pretended to defect to the Soviet Union.
Minsk.
Why Minsk?
To marry a lovely Russian, Ukrainian woman named Marina and bring her to Dallas, Texas.
But you said he was a defector.
A fake defector. It was a CIA program.
Marina Oswalter was a Soviet officer in the KGB.
What does that tell you?
CIA is KGB.
We have a winner.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the same thing with Snowden. Basically, I think this guy's CIA from start to finish. I think Snowden is basically still an agent of some sort. The strange thing about Snowden is that his career biography is quite stellar. Quite an accomplished professional biography by most people's standards, I would say. And yet this is a guy who never seems to have completed any kind of education. He didn't complete his high school education. He apparently later got his diploma or whatever the equivalent is from a community college. He never got an undergraduate degree, yet he was accepted onto a master's course, which, again, he never completed. This sort of perennial underachiever in academic terms, how is he seems to be such an overachiever in professional terms. And when you add it into the fact, pretty much every job this guy's ever had, in fact, every job I know about him ever having, is in some way the security state. That's who was employing. And it wasn't until more information had become available and more documents and more stories and reporting had been made on this that I was wondering, well, the sum total of all of this, and they can talk about however many thousands of pages he supposedly stole from the NSA, but we've only seen at that point a few hundred of them at most. None of it was stuff that I didn't already essentially know or couldn't have already figured out if I'd spent any time thinking about it. And so I was wondering, what's he actually blowing the whistle on here? And is this more about a media campaign than it is about a whistleblower? Whistleblowers don't tend to get a lot of media coverage. Whistleblowers don't tend to really be given the time of day by the mainstream media. And the ones that are, get one or two stories. With this, as soon as the story broke, it was picked up by every media outlet imaginable. And they stuck with the story. Mm. And when does the mainstream media ever stick with any story, let alone one that might actually matter and might actually challenge the status quo in some way? So, well, what's different about this? And then it was watching the documentary about him, or at least the short mini-documentary that Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald made out in when Snowden was in this hotel in China. I found the guy extremely calculative, extremely prepared almost for this. I think Snowden is basically still an agent, CIA from start to finish. If the government had just come out and said, we're passing a security bill that says we can basically spy on anyone's internet connection for any reason and keep as much data for as long as we like. If they just came out and said that, people might actually oppose that. Whereas if you have 2 years of coverage telling you, Snowden, the government is spying on everything in your internet connection and they're keeping all of your data for as long as they like, Snowden. And then the government comes out and says, we're going to have legislation that allows us to do this. It seems like, well, they're doing it anyway, so there's no point opposing it. De facto, they've got the legislation through. Would that have been possible if it wasn't for Snowden? Snowden.
The voice is Tom Secker, author of National Security Cinema. I'm Berkeley Kidd, and this is TwitWit Radio, half true more or less 100% of the time. Each week we drug our guests with truth serum and get them to talk about stuff they regret later.
Do you ever feel like a crumbling machine?
Let it out.
sea without the sand. You're just thrashing about with nowhere to land. But you just keep swimming, trying to stay alive. But the more that you fight, the more that you drown, the more you die. Let it out, let it out.
Listening to Gracie and Rachel.
And now, back to our story.
We were talking about the relationship between the Pentagon Film Office and Hollywood propaganda movies.
Yeah, Oliver Stone, Edward Snowden, JFK, and World Trade Center.
That's a lie.
Look, all movies lie. Come on.
And Oliver Stone knows what really happened.
At Ground Zero or Grassy Knoll.
But he won't name names. Does Edward Snowden know? He stole a million secret documents, didn't he?
With so many secret government documents, you would think so.
Think what?
That something would have turned up about who killed MLK.
Like what?
Or U.S. government drug running.
Putin, Snowden, and Oliver Stone are just friends.
They're obviously in love with each other.
Oh, but it's platonic love.
Platonic love is awful. There are no restraints.
Not even a nipple clamp.
Snowden, the movie, is Stone's greatest movie.
I couldn't follow it. Secret agents are liars. Who can trust anything? I mean, they say.
In the art of war, deception is everything.
I just don't see the point.
That is the point.
Well, it makes me want to throw up my hands and give up show business.
Next question.
Why hasn't Orwell's novel 1984 been remade into a blockbuster hit movie by now?
The Orwell Trust sold the film rights to 1984 to Hollywood film director Ron Howard in 2012.
For 300 points, give a half-true answer to this question. Why did the Orwell Trust sell the film rights to 1984 to director Ron Howard in 2012?
Wait, they did what?
Because Ron Howard is a hack.
Wrong.
Because Oliver Stone hates George Orwell.
Wrong.
So, 1984 never gets made.
We have an answer.
What?
George Bush and Oliver Stone's fathers were both in Skull and Bones.
Does anyone on the panel have another question?
Does Oliver Stone have his hair colorized?
JFK was a limited hangout. The first George Bush was in on the planning, and you know it.
No way. Was W an Oliver Stone movie?
The best Oliver Stone movie since World Trade Center.
World Trade Center is a propaganda movie.
Plain and simple propaganda.
What was the propaganda? What did the movie say?
What was the message of Oliver Stone's movie, World Trade Center?
For an additional 200 points, give a half-true answer to this question. What was the message of Oliver Stone's movie, World Trade Center?
Crap happens.
Wrong.
Let's roll.
Getting warmer.
9/11 was an Islam job.
We have an answer.
Yes, I told you.
Movies like this make people think they know what happened, and it prevents them from really looking into it any further.
Implants, ATP is synthesized in the thylakoid membrane of the chloroplast. The process is called phosphorylation. The machinery is similar to that in mitochondria, except that light energy is used to pump protons across the membrane to produce a proton motor force. ATP synthase then ensues exactly as in oxidative phosphorylation, just like plants. Plants and humans both have adenosine, okay?
Please tune in to the Mouse Report, Tuesdays on Berkeley Liberation Radio. Find us on the TuneIn app.
I wanna be free from all this yeah politics. I wanna be free from all this yeah politicians. I wanna be free from all this caught up monsters. We want to chop man. Why? Shame because fella die. That's why them they try to confuse I and everybody mind. I wanna be free from all this yeah politics. I wanna be free from all this yeah politician. I wanna be free from all this caught up monsters. I wanna be free. We want to chop. Them kukuma kill the king for political reasons. Them no fit talk as he be. Oh yeah, back to politics. Them start to dribble and scheme for the same corruption and tip. No plan, no plan for you and me. I wanna be free from all this yeah politics. I wanna be free from all this yeah politician. I wanna be free from all this caught up monsters. I wanna be free. We want to jump. I wanna be free. Every day, every night, I ask myself, why? She because fella die. That's why them they try to confuse I and everybody mind. I wanna be free. All this yeah politics. I wanna be free from all this yeah politicians. I wanna be free from all this corrupt monsters. I wanna be free. We want to jump. I wanna be free from all this yeah politics. I wanna be free from all this yeah politicians. I wanna be free.
Come to the rather exciting last song of the evening, and this number was written for a movie called The Life of Brian, and we didn't know how to end it. We basically had all our characters heading for crucifixion, so we suggested, right, well, why don't we end with a song? Let's write a nice, cheery, upbeat song we can all sing while being crucified. And we did, and it's been very lucky for us, as they say in the business. Thank you. Some things in life are bad, they can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle, and this'll help things turn out for the best. Ain't always look up the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, damn these silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Ain't always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your sin, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. So always look on the bright side of death. And just before you draw your terminal breath. Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
Worst things happen at sea, you know. I mean, what have you lost? Always come from nothing, but going back to nothing. What have you lost? Nothing! I'd like to thank our wonderful musicians, our great man on sound, Larry Marr, the great and good Danny Farrington, whose idea this was, rather lovely John Dupre, who's been made possible tonight by Virgin Air Miles, Tom Scott and all these fabulous musicians, my wife, my daughter Lily, my doctor, my shrink, my agent, my proctologist, my astrologer, my personal assistant, my massage therapist, my assisted shower person, my vice president in charge of enemas, my plastic surgeon, my penile extension consultant, and my Viagra dealer.